Morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us. We're lucky to have with us today two first-rate scholars, Nelly Lahoud and Daniel Byman, both of whom contributed fascinating articles to this new issue of Foreign Affairs, specifically to the cover package on the War on Terror. You have their short bios. I won't bore you by reading those back to you. Instead, let me tell you a little bit about why we chose to feature Nelly and Dan in this issue and why we've asked them to join us today. In the field of terrorism studies, Nelly has distinguished herself through her immersion in primary sources, especially a trove of Al-Qaeda documents that U.S. Special Forces seized during the 2011 raid on the compound in Pakistan where Osama bin Laden was hiding. Nelly has spent years translating and analyzing these documents, really getting into the heads of bin Laden, his close associates, and his family. We're going to hear about what she's learned. Daniel Byman is, by any measure, one of the world's top experts on terrorism and counterterrorism. He started his career as a CIA analyst focused on the Middle East almost three decades ago. He later served on the staff of the 9/11 Commission and the staff of the Congressional Inquiry into the 9/11 attacks. Dan knows a great deal about terrorists, but he also knows a lot about counterterrorists. Just as Nelly has gotten inside the minds of jihadists, Dan has immersed himself in the psychology and the sociology and the politics that shape the fight against them. So Nelly and Dan, thank you both for joining us. Welcome. When we started planning this issue, we knew that the theme would resonate owing to the anniversary of 9/11. We had no idea it would be quite so relevant. Events in the past months have, I think, given everybody a kind of deja vu. Afghanistan, Taliban, Al-Qaeda, safe havens, counterinsurgency, counterterrorism. You know, these were topics that for years dominated our field and filled the pages of our magazine. In recent years, they had sort of receded a bit for reasons we'll discuss. They've obviously come roaring back. We'll get to Afghanistan soon, but I want to start with 9/11 itself. Nelly, in your article, you call the 9/11 attacks a Pyrrhic victory for Al-Qaeda. You call it a catastrophic success for bin Laden. Can you explain what you mean?
Thank you, Justin. Firstly, I'm honored to be part of this event and also that my article features in the issue commemorating this solemn occasion. And of course, delighted to be sharing this virtual panel with you and Dr. Byman. The details of what happened on 9/11 are widely known, but it bears repeating that on that day, a non-state actor, Al-Qaeda, inflicted the deadliest foreign attack on the soil of the world's superpower. And nearly 3,000 people perished on that day. From Al-Qaeda's perspective, of course, the attacks were a triumph. There's no doubt about it. And Al-Qaeda and bin Laden did the marvelous job in their public statements post 9/11 to project strength and to remind the world of the victories they achieved on 9/11. But now that we have Al-Qaeda's internal communications, the story is very different. And let me say a few words, if I may, about what we, when we talk about Al-Qaeda's internal communications. Now, these were recovered by the Special Operations Forces during the Abbottabad raid that killed bin Laden. And they recovered, according to the CIA, about 470,000 files. Now, the actual internal communications, the letters, the correspondence are about nearly 6,000 Arabic pages. And these were not written for public consumption. To remind the audience, the bin Ladens were adhering to strict security measures to avoid capture. And the only means of communications between bin Laden and his associates who were hiding, mostly in North Waziristan, was through letters that were transported by couriers. Out of the 6,000 pages, out of thousands of pages, only one letter tells us about the mechanics of this. And one letter describes that these letters were saved on SIM cards. They were hidden in an envelope, and upon reaching their destination, they required to be extracted. The Al-Qaeda's leaders, Even despite all this, they went to great lengths to hide themselves in case these SIM cards fell into the wrong hands. So they would, you know, use aliases that they change periodically. And even Bin Laden's successor, Ayman al-Zawahiri, often referred to himself in the third person in the letters, just in case those SIM cards fell into the wrong hands. So we have Al-Qaeda secrets here, thanks to the Special Operations Forces. We have access to something that we wouldn't have been able imagine to have actually had access to. And it is through these letters, really, that we know that the 9/11 attacks were a catastrophic victory for Al-Qaeda. To start with, Al-Qaeda did not anticipate and did not plan that the United States would go to war in response of the 9/11 attacks. So the US-led invasion was launched on October 7, 2011. On December 6 or December 7 that same year, the Taliban regime collapsed and Al-Qaeda was crushed. In the article, I cite one of the letters noting, we Muslims were defiled, desecrated, and our state was ripped asunder. Our lands were occupied, our resources were plundered. This is what happened to jihadis in general and to us in Al-Qaeda in particular. This was a letter written in September 2004. Other letters speak, and let me quote from other letters, they're not in the articles. They speak of colossal consequences of the 9/11 attacks. The Americans' response was beyond anyone's expectations. The Crusader campaign was very severe. It was followed by confusion, scattering, and an overwhelming chaos. Many people perished, a lot of money lost, and more. So there's much more of this kind of language in the letters.
And the portrait that emerges then is of an organization that was really hobbled in the aftermath of this. Is that right?
Absolutely. And we also learned from the letters that Bin Laden himself had to disappear out of the scene. And he didn't really regain command of Al-Qaeda and reconnect with his associates until 2004. And during that time, Al-Qaeda's senior leaders were either captured or killed. Initially, they fled to Pakistan, and there they were met by a campaign of arrest. And according to the letters, some 600 brothers were captured. And the others, once they saw what happened in Afghanistan, they had nowhere else to go, and they headed west. They crossed illegally into Iran. They did so around February 2002. They crossed illegally and they were helped by some Sunni brothers in Iran to help them forge IDs and so on. But by December that year, the Iranian authorities had tracked them down and they detained them. So, this is very significant when you have the top tier of Al-Qaeda's leaders, except for Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri. Now, more importantly, perhaps, than all of this is that Al-Qaeda's international terrorism came to a halt. The only other attack that Al-Qaeda was able to orchestrate after 9/11 was the 2002 Mombasa attack in November. This was an attack that consisted of two operations. One attacked the Paradise Hotel, killing about 15 people. The other tried to shoot an Israeli Al Al jetliner as it was taking off from the Mombasa airport, and it missed. But the reason this attack was able to be carried out is because the planners for these attacks had been dispatched from Afghanistan in late 2000, before Operation Enduring Freedom was launched.
Right. So after the operation was actually extremely successful, and it really curtailed the organization, the core organization's ability to do much else. Dan, I your article focuses more on the United States and its allies than on Al-Qaeda. But interestingly, the story that Nelly is telling is sort of one of unintended consequences and a kind of mixed success. And interestingly, I think that's mirrored to a certain extent by the story from the other side. You kind of talk about the war on terror as a qualified success. It's an outcome that you describe as good enough. Maybe you could tell us from the point of view of the U.S. and its allies, in what ways the war on terror succeeded and in what ways it's failed?
Thanks for the question, Justin. Let me echo Dr. Lahoud's thanks for being asked to talk today, and also my pleasure at being on a panel with her. So when we think about success, it's important to go back to the immediate aftermath of 9/11. And I recall, and I'm sure many people on this webinar do as well, the tremendous sense of doom that pervaded most of the discussion about the future threat. And there was a sense in the United States that there were literally thousands of members of a kind of shadow network that were poised to attack, that there was Plan B and Plan C and Plan D that were all in place, and that we were going to see far worse attacks, including perhaps even chemical or biological attacks, and so on. So there's a real sense of fear that dominates US thinking. And for the first couple of years, the perception of people in the administration is that the next 9/11 could happen tomorrow, and that their policies have to be tailored to that very real possibility. And so they're focused on another catastrophic terrorist attack. So a lot of what they do, which in hindsight seems like an overreaction, is very much based on the threat perception of the time. But if you look at what has happened, which is according to New America, 107 Americans have died in the US homeland from jihadist terror. So if you look at that number, that's, to be clear, 107 too many. But that's far smaller than anyone would have anticipated in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. And the number one concern of every US administration was minimizing the attacks on the US homeland. And in that sense, I think it's been a tremendous success in terms of, you know, that one statistic. But it's come at a very high cost. And we're all talking about the cost with regard to Afghanistan. Iraq, of course, was tremendously costly in both human and material terms. But also we've seen a broader destabilization in the Middle East. And there are a lot of causes on this. I don't want to pin everything on the war on terrorism or the invasion of Iraq, but certainly the invasion of Iraq in particular hurt the stability of this region. And so when we talk about success, a lot is going to depend on where you sit. And if you're talking about the security of US citizens in the US homeland, which again is a priority for any administration, it looks pretty good. When you're talking about conditions in the Middle East, the spread of jihadism there, the ideas that Al-Qaeda and later the Islamic State put in the atmosphere, there things start to look a lot more grim.
You have a kind of thought experiment in your article, sort of imagining what would happen if a group like Al-Qaeda or one of the successor groups tried to pull off an attack like 9/11 today. Why would it be so much harder for them to do that?
I think many people who are watching this webinar are familiar from COVID-19 of the concept of the Swiss cheese model, that there's a layer of defense that, like a piece of Swiss cheese, has holes in it, but then you put another piece next to it and some of those holes are plugged. And if you get enough pieces of cheese, you actually plug all the holes. Counterterrorism is very much like that. So removing the haven in Afghanistan that Al-Qaeda enjoyed under the Taliban is tremendously consequential. They were able to essentially train a mini army. Their leadership had a high degree of protection there. And now leaders of this group around the world are under constant pressure. It doesn't mean they cannot do anything, but it means that if they communicate, they are worried about this being intercepted and they would be targeted. If recruits come to the haven, they might be killed. And if they leave, the same thing. And also in general, it's hard to do long-term plots. There's been an effort to go after cells and networks around the world. So the broader support systems, whether it's fundraising or propaganda or assistance during an operation, that's under siege. There's a lot of effort in the US homeland. Anyone who's been on an airplane in the last 20 years knows that it's no longer, it's never particularly fun, but it's even less so today because of security measures. And then of course, the American Muslim community has been engaged deeply in working with law enforcement and the FBI to go after the very small number of dangerous people in the United States. So each of these efforts by itself only gets you so far, but together they've proven very potent.
What's interesting, of course, to me about that is that you point out the way that the American Muslim population has sort of contributed to the counterterrorism success of the United States. As you, if you go back to the aftermath of 9/11, that was not the image of that community that pervaded at all in American politics and still exists as there's fear-mongering, there's scaremongering about it. I think it's interesting that you highlight that. Nellie, Dan alluded to some of these U.S. capabilities, the intelligence capabilities that made it harder for al-Qaeda to replicate its success after 9/11. From the correspondence, what struck me in your article is that even before all of that, or even without all of that, the kind of massive challenges that faced this organization, a sort of basic challenge of management. You know, a lot of people on this call know how hard it is to manage an organization of well-educated, skilled, basically well-adjusted professionals. I sometimes think to myself, imagine trying to run an organization of, you know, violent zealots committed to mayhem and destruction, no matter how strategic they might be. I'm wondering what you can tell us about what the corresponding suggests about this challenge and the effect that it had on what's happened during the past two decades.
Yes, well, I mean, again, we have to remember and keep in mind that Bin Laden was hiding and his associates were also hiding. When they resumed contact in 2004, his principal instruction to his associates is kumun, hide. He gave them zero latitude. The only way that you want to communicate, you need to communicate through letters. So put this in perspective. How else are they going to imagine? How are they going to be able to manage all the others? Now at that time, As you said, the Iraq war happened, and this was the rise of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi in Iraq. So that was a lifeline for the jihadis. And I thought, great. In one of the letters, you know, one of the associates tells Bin Laden that, you know, when God knew of our afflictions, he opened the door of jihad for us in Iraq. So thank you, God, for the Iraq war. And so they established firstly this merger with Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's group, and Bin Laden was very pleased about it. And he thought, great, this is all gonna, you know, bring the global community of Muslims. They're going to realize the importance of the jihadis. They're gonna join in. But there was no mechanism in place to manage them firsthand. But al-Qaeda gave al-Zarqawi the al-Qaeda brand. And sooner, no sooner did they do that until we started seeing the divisions within the jihadi groups in Iraq. And that came to be more of the same. So yes, there was relationships, there were contacts, attempts to influence these groups from al-Qaeda's leaders. But they were in no position to be able to exercise that influence or to be able to direct them. As far as Bin Laden was concerned, he had no interest whatsoever in having violence or engaging in local attacks against the local governments. He was furious, for instance, with the al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula group that was trying to mount local attacks against the local government, as well as the Houthis in Yemen. He wanted none of that. All he wanted is that what he hoped and what he aspired is that the jihadi groups would coordinate, they would try to replicate the 9/11 attacks. This is the kind of global jihad that he wanted. And repeatedly, they were failing him. And you could tell from the letters, they're trying to influence them and they were failing. But here we go again, we're talking about people who are hiding. Of course, they're not gonna be able to do much. So it was both, it was like a catch 22 dilemma, if you like, for al-Qaeda. They made them bigger than what they actually are. And at the same time, they were doing exactly the opposite of what al-Qaeda wanted.
Right. Let's turn to Afghanistan, actually, because it's come up a couple of times and I think it's on a lot of people's minds now. Nelly, I'm gonna stay with you for a second and ask you, the Taliban and the relationship between al-Qaeda and the Taliban comes up a lot in this correspondence. And I wonder, you know, what do we learn from that? Specifically, what do we learn about that is useful to the question that's on answering the question that I think that is on everyone's mind, which is with the Taliban back in control of Afghanistan, how likely are we to see them offering safe havens or even collaborating with not the core al-Qaeda group, which as you talk about is sort of defunct, but with their successor groups and with some of the groups that have filled the vacuum since the demise of the core organization. What does it tell us about that relationship that has a bearing on that question?
For good reasons, there's a big question mark about the Afghan Taliban. Now, they concluded a deal with the United States promising to prevent terrorism, whether by individuals or by groups, from Afghan soil. And we all have to wonder whether they can really deliver on that agreement. Now, many have rightly criticized the Trump administration's deal with the agreement with the Taliban that excluded the Afghan government. And that's very true. Having said that, the actual agreement is a nightmare for Al-Qaeda. They saw the writing on the wall as early as 2008, and they started fearing those Taliban, Afghan Taliban, who want to distance themselves from Al-Qaeda and from the accusation of terrorism. These we see in the letters back in 2007, 2008. In 2010, Ayman al-Zawahiri writes to bin Laden that he thought that the Afghan Taliban was psychologically prepared to enter into such deal. He predicted it almost, he predicted the terms of the agreement almost. And he said, you know, if there were, they would probably be prepared to have that agreement that would allow them to return to power and render Al-Qaeda impotent. Now, what Al-Qaeda wanted to do and clearly failed to do, and I'm going to use the bin Laden language that he used in the letters, that they wanted to strengthen the sincere Taliban movement against those who turned their back on religion. Now, the fact that those who turned their back on religion have won the day, this must be devastating for Al-Qaeda. And the fact that Al-Qaeda last week or so released a statement, you know, congratulating the Taliban on their victories and so on, behind the scenes, this situation, I have no doubt that it is very, very different, because the people who concluded the agreement, some of them are actually cited in the letters, they are loathed by Al-Qaeda's leaders. So this is clearly not a good situation for Al-Qaeda.
Dan, I'm sorry. Oh, sorry. No, Dan, you've written about this. You wrote a great piece for foreignaffairs.com on this very question about what to expect, how worried should we be? What's your take on this?
So I share, if you want to call it optimism, I share Nelly's relative sense of optimism, but I want to qualify it a lot because I think there's a lot we simply don't know. So I think that there are incentives for the Taliban to minimize Al-Qaeda's involvement in, terrorism against the West in particular, so the United States and Europe. There are also incentives for Pakistan, which supports the Taliban, to push that in the same direction. Al-Qaeda, as I think many people would agree, is itself relatively weak and its own capacity to do so is limited. And there are all these other steps, whether it's homeland defense or international intelligence cooperation designed to keep it down. That said, there are a couple question marks. So one thing that's not a question mark, before I go into the uncertainties, is that this is a win for the broader jihadist movement. Right. They said, you know, look, if we fight hard and bleed and sacrifice, we can beat the United States just as we beat the Soviet Union. And the U.S. is leaving because it's bleeding too much, because the cost is too high. And it's a Taliban victory. And this is inspiring. You see groups around the Muslim world being inspired by this. In addition, the Taliban has had 20 years since 9/11 to cut the relationship with Al-Qaeda. And it hasn't done so. And you would think if they were truly pragmatic, they would have dumped these guys a long time ago. But they've refused to do so. Now, they've claimed restrictions and so on. But it's important to note that the relationship is still there. And they've actually been very hesitant to really kind of openly admit past ties and even who's responsible for 9/11. So I think there's a genuine question mark about where this is going to go in the future. I can cite a bunch of pragmatic reasons to say that the Taliban is likely to be careful, but the Taliban in the past haven't always been pragmatic. Even before 9/11, they were very, you know, upset by Al-Qaeda attacks, for example, on U.S. embassies in Africa. But they allowed Al-Qaeda to continue operating. So the fact that they were angry about this didn't fundamentally change Al-Qaeda's freedom of operations. And what I would say is a possible compromise position might be that Al-Qaeda is able to assist in operations against India and in the broader South Asian community, also to some degree in the Middle East. So there may be some possibility where there's less threat to the United States, but there's still continued Al-Qaeda operations elsewhere. But I really want to stress, I think there's a lot we don't know here. And I'm skeptical of very firm predictions in either direction.
Can I just ask you one follow-up to that, Dan? A lot of people have talked about this rivalry between the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. Of course, Nelly, you write about that to a certain extent in your piece. In Afghanistan, this is sort of playing out in an interesting way. And I'm wondering what you can tell us about that rivalry, how salient it is, and what effect it might have on conditions there and on U.S. policy.
So one thing that Nelly and others have written very powerfully on is that one of the big disasters for Al-Qaeda was the emergence of a rival movement. And part of this is their inability to exert control over the jihadist movement after 9/11. And so you see movements at first having a high degree of autonomy, and then what becomes the Islamic State openly rejects Al-Qaeda and becomes a fierce critic. So, you know, in Syria, they're actually shooting at Al-Qaeda-linked groups. And even beyond the bullets, they are blasting Al-Qaeda for, just as an example, its relationship with Iran. And so there are power differences, and there are also differences in interpretation. Questions about whether to declare an Islamic State, how to treat journalists. There's kind of a host of differences among these groups. And this is a very bitter rivalry. And in a way, they both suffer as a result, because it disillusions people when they're seeing some of the, you know, possible places to go actually just be about shooting other Muslims. And so there are real problems in this. And this shows up in Afghanistan, where you have Al-Qaeda working very closely with the Taliban. And then you have the Islamic State province there that rejects the Taliban, that is shooting back and forth in terms of lives lost on both sides. And some of this, you could say, is doctrinal, but a lot of it is just about power politics, that there are disaffected people from a range of jihadist groups that have joined the local Islamic State organization as a way of making a power bid themselves. And so this sort of infighting at times makes the violence worse, but also makes the movement weaker.